Succession number 28361, Reel 7.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 7. You were saying there are not many good training grounds on water. Were you able to do any training over private land?
No, because such agricultural land as there is so poor and so limited that no farmer would allow anyone to go on his land because they would, you know, wreck what is already a pretty inadequate place.
So you're doing this rather restricted training. How long did you carry on with that?
Well, not long, because what then happened was to me personally, I was sent back to England to do a winter warfare course, which actually took place mainly in Scotland, and it started in Dartmoor with a period of sort of hardening up, walking. Mainly consisting of carrying larger loads every day further. So you started with, and they loaded you up with old radio batteries, the old, you know, this size radio batteries.
Yes. Was that 22 sets?
Well, I don't know what the batteries were for, but they were, I can't remember which set they were for, but they were not wet batteries, they were dry batteries, they were very heavy. And you were given a Bergen rucksack and that. And then the first day you marched, you know, a modest distance, 10 miles, with carrying 20 pounds, whatever it was. And the next day you did 30 pounds and you marched 15 miles, and you ended up on the last day by carrying about 60 pounds over 30 miles. So it was a, you know, to sort of get you back in the swing of things, and also to wear in the new boots that they've given you, called cold, wet.
How did they differ from your normal boots?
Well, they were a boot that had emerged from experience in Korea. Mm. And they were double thickness uppers to give you some form of insulation. They had an insole which you put in, rather like the insole you used to get with a DMS boot. Mm. You know, that sort of plasticky insole.
Sure.
And then they had a padded... slightly padded top. So they were a better quality boot than the issue, and they were slightly but not completely waterproof, in the sense that you could dash through a deep puddle and not get wet.
did you dubbin them to improve?
Yeah, we dubbined them, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
what sort of sole did they have on them?
They had rubber soles.
Was it a snow track pattern?
No. It was a pattern rather like the bottom of a DMS boot. I mean, it was a, you know, it was, or the bottom of an SV boot. It was no particular clever pattern, and it was not a directly molded sole either. So again, its waterproof qualities were not high.
The stitches let the water in.
Yeah, and then we went from there to Scotland by train.
Sorry, when you were doing these long walks on Dartmoor, yeah, were you on your own or were you...
We were in pairs.
You were in
and
pairs.
There was no tactical significance at all. You just set off and were told... All the walks ended at Bickley. Mm. So you would just drop further and further out into Dartmoor every day and walked in. Mm. And it was about, I can't remember, it would have been February, I suppose. Mm. Something like that.
It sounds like a bit of a shock to the system after being warm in sunny Malta.
Yes, we were young, resilient. And then we went to Scotland by train. Mm. And we were up there, I think, for 4 weeks. And we did ski training using cross-country skis at Aviemore. Mm. And the course was a preparation for people who were going to then go on to Norway and do a longer course. Mm. So it was for the people who were going to do that. In fact, we were not going to do that. It was merely to give us a bit of extra training before we then went and did other things, which I'll come on to in a minute. We lived in a hut in Aviemore, but we were out most of the week doing either living in snow holes or tents snow holes and or tents. And skiing, we use skins to climb hills with, not the Norwegian technique of waxing. And we use snowshoes, and then we learned how to build snow holes, how to live in them, how to live, fight and move in cold weather conditions.
How do you actually build a snow hole? What's the technique involved?
Right, well, there are two techniques. One is, if you are in a piece of ground where there's a convenient snow bank, you tunnel into the snow bank and then enlarge a sort of cave inside, and then you, having done that, you then block up the front of the cave and dig an exit which is below the level of the cave which you've now dug, so all the cold air falls out of the hole you've just dug, and then you get a ski stick from the outside and you put it through the roof of this cave which you've just constructed, so that the end of the ski stick, the handle end, drops through into where you're sitting, and it doesn't come through because the basket prevents it from dropping through. And the object of that is to maintain a circulation of air, so that if it snows in the night, all you have to do is to push, and you'll push away a tube for yourself
to make certain
you don't asphyxiate. You also have a candle, a light, all light, and if the candle starts going out, you know there isn't enough oxygen, and you better do something about it. And you have a candle sentry, so someone awake all night to make certain you're not going to asphyxiate yourself.
How many men can you get into a single
cave? As many as you like. I mean, you could make a snow cave. I've seen snow holes the size of this room. It depends really on how far back the snow goes, the quality of the snow. Will it sustain, you know, having a big roof? And also, how many men there are. And they're very warm. I mean, I've sat in a snow hole cooking in shirt sleeves, and the temperature outside is minus 20. It's the best form of living in cold weather, much better than living in a tent. It's much warmer. So that was the first thing. Second, another way of digging a snow hole, which I've used, is if you're in flat ground, and this is usually an emergency one, we haven't got time to find a suitable place. You just dig a slit trench, normal slit trench, in the snow, and then you cut snow blocks and you roof it over with these blocks, and then you leave a hole to get into. Now that's a very cold snow hole because all the cold air drops into it, but what it does is protect you from the wind, and you can cook in there and survive.
What do you use to dig the hole with, or the cave with?
A cable, a shovel.
A shovel. Yeah, a shovel.
No, in those conditions, every other man will carry a snow shovel, which is quite a broad, as a light, short-handled shovel about that, but it's got a broad head, so you can get out lots of snow quickly. I mean, if you had to, you would do it with your mess tin. You know, in an emergency, if you hadn't got a snow shovel.
If you're digging a hole for yourself in a bank one of the first time, roughly how long do you think it would take you to burrow in far enough to make it viable?
Half an hour. Because what you do is you just dig into the bank. If you're in a survival situation, you just dig into the bank, so you've got a sort of cave like that, all right? And then what you do is you block the front of the cave up with snow blocks, just leaving a bit of the bottom, and then you dig a tunnel up to it, so that you end up with the cave which is blocked in with an exit hole out the bottom like that. So that would take you, if you were competent, it would take you about half an hour.
What about the emergency one, the slip trench one? Would that be?
Well, again, that could take you about half an hour. It depends what the condition of the snow is.
Presumably, that's a matter of judgment, learning how to assess the quality of the snow and whether it can be.
Yes, and it's a question of experience. And if it's wet snow, you can't dig a snow hole. If it's melting snow, there's no way you can dig a snow hole. You've got to then make some other kind of shelter. You've got to hope that you're in an area where there are trees, and you can cut down trees and make some kind of a shelter for yourself out of brushwood, a brushwood bivy, very cold. Or you're carrying a tent. I mean, if you've got a tent, you can put that up. So you go for whatever is the quickest option, and that will give you the maximum protection in the time.
What were the conditions like at Aviemore when you were up there? Were there low temperatures?
By Norwegian standards, no. I mean, it went down to about -5 or -6, but it was very wet and unpleasant compared with Norway, where I trained later. And you get wet, and therefore you get cold very quickly. It's not actually the ideal place to go training for winter warfare. You know.
Is there anywhere in the United Kingdom that is
no.
ideal for
no.
or better for winter warfare training?
No, there isn't anywhere better. No.
And the skiing, had you skied before?
No.
How did you get on with that?
All right. I mean, it's cross-country skiing, not downhill skiing. The standard of instruction wasn't as good as it became in the Royal Marines later, because they weren't the people able to put it across. And in any case, it didn't matter to the people the other people on the course, because they were then going to go to Norway for about 6 or 7 weeks and learn to ski under Norwegian instructors. So skiing that we did there was very preliminary. And some of the equipment wasn't anything like as good as we got later on.
What about the clothing, apart from the cold weather boots? The
clothing was clothing that had been introduced as a result of experience in Korea, and was effectively the combat clothing that the British Army had in the 1960s, the green combat clothing, and it was double material to make it windproof to a degree, and you had a pair of trousers and a jacket and a hood, and you had string vests, and you wore the normal army shirt, you know, the army shirt, prickly.
Quite surge. Other ranks were used on.
Exactly, and a jersey. It wasn't bad. It was a great deal of improvement on sort of battle dress, but it wasn't anything like as good as the stuff we have now, or they have now.
Was there any thought perhaps of training you also to use snowshoes as well?
Oh yes, we had snowshoes as well. Had both, yes. Mm. Yes. But snowshoes are a very slow way of getting around compared with skis. Mm. With trained people. Yes, we had snowshoes.
So this was a course in living in winter conditions, moving in winter conditions.
Yeah.
Did it deal with fighting in winter conditions?
At a very rudimentary level, remembering that it was designed as a preliminary course before people went to Norway and then did another 12 weeks. Mm. So it was very, very low-level stuff. I mean, you carried weapons and that sort of thing, and you had sentries at night, but there was no real tactical picture being painted into it at all, not a meaningful one anyway.
What about care of weapons in such an environment, low temperatures and so
forth?
Were there any special measures?
Yes. I mean, for example, you should never take your weapon into your tent, because if the weapon's outside and then you take it inside and the snow melts, and then you take it outside, all the parts freeze up. So weapons are always left outside, and other things are left outside too, like binoculars and optical instruments, which will, if you take them inside, any moisture in them will get condensation from the heat of being inside a tent, which will then freeze when you take it outside again. So weapons are always left covered, but out in the outside. At least that's what we were taught. I mean, it may be different now, but that's what we were taught.
Did the bolt action rifle freeze up with the
It didn't on us, no. And later, in Norway, you know, we carried SLRs and GPMGs. They didn't freeze up, no. Mm. They had special winter oils and ways of cleaning the weapons, so it doesn't.
What about feeding?
Then we must talk about then, because we can talk about Norway later, if you like. But then we had Canadian petrol stoves, which we cooked on. And we ate the ordinary standard issue British Army 24-hour ration pack, which are not all that satisfactory actually, because they don't give you enough calories. Because you actually need something like 6,000 calories a day if you're expending energy in the cold. And these don't give you enough. And of course, the only way you can get water... Do you want me to stop with it? No, you don't. The only way you can get water, if there, unless there happens to be a stream that's unfrozen and flowing near you, is by melting snow, which is very expensive in fuel. It takes a lot of fuel to melt even one pint of water, because snow is very... there's a lot of air, and huge wadges of snow melt down to nothing. And of course, you've got to carry the fuel on your back. So, huge weights or huge amount of the weight is just fuel to melt water and cook. So it's a very time consuming and expensive way of cooking.
And putting tents up and making sure they remain stable, is that something that is a particular skill?
Yes, I mean you get taught how to do it, and the tent was reasonably easy to put up, and they were quite good tents. They're not bad.
Were they made specifically for the purpose?
Yeah, they were made for the purpose. They were mountain tents. Yes, that's what we were using in Scotland. I mean, the Norwegian army used different sorts of tents.
And this course you were on 6 weeks.
It was 1 week preparation. In Devon, and 4 weeks in Scotland.
It's a rather short period of time to be learning how to live in Arctic conditions.
Absolutely, but bearing in mind it was designed for people who were going to Norway for another 12 weeks, so the majority of us went on to that. We were really doing it just to give us an insight into the training before we went on to the next bit.
And did you then go on to Norway for the...
No.
You didn't?
No, we didn't go on to Norway. What happened with us then is we went and completed our officer's training package, which consisted of a number of courses, most of which were a complete waste of time, and were designed to prepare you should you be sent to sea in a ship's detachment as an officer.
So what were they training you to do?
You were sent on a series of courses, and they were all bits, you know, a couple of weeks here, 3 weeks here, 4 weeks there, and I can't remember them all, but they were things like the electrical course, a navigation course, a gunnery course, naval gunnery course, damage control course, and what was fun but a complete waste of time as well, was 9 months at the Royal Naval College Greenwich doing a thing called the Junior Officers War Course, which existed in those days but didn't exist now. Now these courses were all courses which were then followed by or done by naval sub-lieutenants who'd done their time as midshipmen in the fleet. And for them, they, of course, were very important because they were professional courses, fitting them for their jobs as naval officers. And they were... they counted towards their marks for their lieutenant certificate. And therefore they took them quite seriously because they mattered. To us, they didn't actually matter at all.
Did they count towards their seniority, then?
Yes.
In the list?
Yes, they did. And this period of courses, which went on for about a year, was followed then by the only two meaningful courses we did, which was a small arms course at the Royal Marine Small Arms Wing at Browndown and the platoon commander's course at Warminster. So we then, having left our commandos and did the, not all of us, but some of us did this winter warfare course, not all, we then embarked on a year of a mixture of what was actually quite fun in the social sense, but a total waste of the taxpayers' money. Then we actually got down to the serious business of doing the small arms course at Browndown, and then the very, very good platoon commander's course at Warminster, which both of which I thoroughly enjoyed.
Do you remember anything that you learned on the electrics, navigation?
Absolutely none at all.
And damage control?
Nothing. I don't remember any of it. I thought I was totally bored the whole time.
Isn't it not a custom that the Marines man one of the turrets?
Yes, it was a custom then. I could have been sent to a ship, but I just hoped and prayed I wouldn't be.
Did you have any sort of influence over where you were likely to be sent at that stage?
No, I mean, none whatever. Mm. When we'd finished all these courses, the military secretary came down to the officer's mess at Eastney and said, I've got... He sort of read out a list of vacancies. And when he said, go back to a commander, I stuck my hand in the air, and that's where I went.
Do you remember anything from the junior officers' war course, what you learned on that? What the syllabus was and how?
The syllabus was a lot of maths.
Maths.
Mm. Physics and chemistry, all of which was a complete waste of time as far as I was concerned. A little bit of naval history, which was the only bit that interested me. If there had been more, I would have found it very interesting. But most of it was sort of technical stuff, which was absolutely no value to us at all.
What, ship handling? Or
well, no, nothing like that.
Naval tactics?
No, it was mainly hours of dreary mathematics and chemistry and physics and things like that, which I hated. And a bit of what I would call, I suppose you would call it now, sort of defence studies, but taught in a very rudimentary and not particularly clever way. I mean, it was an opportunity which was totally missed. If they had said, look, there are huge options, you can learn a language, or you can take an elective in military history, I would have jumped at it. But it was very rigidly set with no, as I recall, any sort of latitude for choosing things that interest you, and I just found the whole syllabus totally boring, and the only reason I enjoyed it was so close to London, and I had lots of girlfriends in London and had a smashing time insofar as my pocket allowed me to.
So then you went on to the small arms, you said it was good. Now what did you learn there at the small arms?
Well, what we were doing there was reminding us of what our trade was, and we were actually buffing up our small arms skills in all the infantry weapons, and also we were learning how to instruct in infantry weapons and how to run ranges and that sort of thing. So we would be given lessons to teach. So instead of being on the receiving end, we would be learning how to instruct in infantry weapons and also how to run ranges of various kinds, make certain that they were safely run, that they were properly run, people got the benefit out of it, and sort of things we'd be given to do would be an exercise where, you know, you've just arrived here, your CO turns around to you and says, I want you to run a field firing program for the whole commando next week, here's a piece of ground to go out and wreck it, and you then had to work out where you could put all the templates in so that you could have safe, you know, grenade throwing here, anti-tank firing here, something else going on here without everyone killing each other and without killing the local population. Mm. So those sort of things, which were very useful, of course.
This is practical stuff.
Yeah. Mm. And so that was excellent. And then we went to Warminster, where we met up with a lot of our chums in the army, who are contemporaries. Mm. And it was socially great fun, and also professionally very interesting.
And you'd already done training effectively as a platoon commander before you'd gone out and joined your commando. And
yeah, sure.
You trained with them in the desert in Libya, and you effectively seen the inside of the platoon working when you were doing part of the stage of your training based around Linz and Bickley. Mm. So what was new about what you learned at Warminster?
It was a very good revision to start with. Also, at Warminster, all the kit was there. You had tanks, APCs of the Kangaroos. They weren't the sort of APCs we have now, the open-top Kangaroos. There were all the bits of kit was there. You had a demonstration battalion, and you had the area in which to do the training, and so the training was very realistic. And okay, some of it, a lot of it, was revision, but it was very much needed revision. And in those days, a lot of people from the army went to Ormuz after they'd been platoon commanders for quite a long time. In fact, all our contemporaries on the course were of the particular intake that had done something like a year or 2 years in their battalions first. And we had chaps with military crosses on the course, who'd been in Kenya and Malaya and things like that. So, because the system worked, that some courses went straight from Sandhurst to Warminster. Others went away back to their battalion for anything up to 2 years and then came to Warminster. And of course, the poor old DS had much more trouble with the latter, you know, with the Marines who'd been away and the Army officers who'd been away, who thought they knew it all and were slightly cocky, than they did with cadets straight out of Sandhurst, who, on the whole, tended to be more biddable, but a bit stale with being under training. So, you know, you couldn't have it always.
And what did you learn then that was new when you
at Warminster?
Where was your knowledge extended? When did they start pushing back?
My knowledge was extended with I'd never operated with APCs before. Mm. We did much better fighting in built-up areas at Imber than I'd done before. I was able to extend the knowledge of operating with armour much more again. Mm. And also, they were beginning to teach a much slicker form of platoon battle drill. The platoon battle drills have become rather set in concrete. And Warminster was just beginning to teach a slicker and revert, actually, to the sort of battle drills they'd had by the end of the Second World War. And what had happened, I think, was that we're now talking about 1956. The sort of generation of officers who had been company commanders in the Second World War were now either COs or had gone. And in the intervening period, the battle drills and platoon tactics had become rather stereotyped and sort of by the book. And they were trying now at once to sort of loosen it up a bit. And this was the first time we'd come across this different style. And again, it was interesting and you know, it was new to everyone, because we all found ourselves, both ourselves and our army contemporaries, not having been faced with this particular way of doing it before, and it took us a bit of time to learn it.
It sounds like it was an experimental period.
It was. It was a way of cutting down the time spent giving orders before a platoon attack, actually. Yeah. And I think it was partly because they were realising that the era of the APC was about to burst on the British Army, and therefore they were going to have to cut down the amount of waffle that went on into a platoon attack and set it more onto a sort of drills, automatic reactions, more on the sort of Soviet style.
Well, that's how it had worked, I think, towards the end of the Second World War.
Yes.
It was a case of quite often the platoon that was experienced not even having to have an order, but
exactly.
Started shaking out into the right
exactly.
Order.
Yeah. Well, what had happened in the intervening years was it had become more formalised, and what they were doing, they were trying to get back to a crisper way of doing it. Mm. And we were the first course, I think, in which they tried it out on.
Was the training at Warminster at that time, was it primarily out on the ground, or was there quite a lot of classroom work in preparation?
There was both. Mm. There was syndicate discussions. Mm. There was central instruction in the Blenheim Hall, and then there were rudimentary sort of putting you through your paces on the ground, followed by formalised exercises.
Up to what scale did those exercises go? Without the battalion plus?
Battalion, because there was an infantry battalion there as the demonstration battalion, which was the Inniskilling Fusiliers. And we were actually, at the same time we were there, there was a company commander's course. Because in those days they used to run a thing called the Infantry Company Commander's Course, which was running in parallel with the Platoon Commander's Course. So the student body on any exercise, when the 27th of Foot deployed onto Salisbury Plain, the company commanders, one of the company commanders would take over the CO's job. Mm-hmm. One of the company commanders on the company would, you know, all the jobs down to Company 2IC would be taken over by the company commanders, of course. All the jobs of platoon commanders, platoon sergeants and section commanders would be taken over by the officers on the platoon commanders course. So the whole battalion was being run by students.
How did the soldiers in the battalion take to this?
Can I just, do you mind if I just, how do they...